Lorraine's office is.
There we go.
That you can sign out a skull. Since we have a limited number of skulls, only one skull per lab table, which means we have 13 skulls signed out at any particular time. So what you do is, for each lab table, you select one individual to sign out a skull. You don't really sign out the skull, you go there, and today it'll be Dr. Singh, and following weeks it'll be Doreen, is you leave your ID there. And you have to return the skull by 5 o'clock, or they'll keep your ID until next time, which is not a good thing. Okay, the time is almost limited if you think about it, but I assure you guys that there's more than enough time to review all the information on the skull. Now, in previous years, students have purchased skulls on their own. Since your access to the skull is limited to the assigned lab time, you may want to study the skull at your leisure at home. You can purchase a real bone skull, which is typically over $1,000. You could find them on eBay, and if you did a Google search, skull, bone, etc., you would find it, and they are really expensive. If you have the money, that's very nice. However, there is an alternative, and these are plastic skulls. They are not that good, but they're not that expensive. You can get them something like for about $50, $60, which are real bad ones, to about $200, which are a bit better. There is a third alternative. The previous year, students have purchased plastic skulls. You may want to ask them if you could borrow their plastic skull to use at home to review the information. You may also have relatives or friends who are dentists. In the old days, part of your toolkit, and you come in, you get a toolkit, right? All sorts of things. They would also give you a skull, which you paid for, ultimately. And some of the older dentists around still have their skulls. So if you know anybody and they have a skull, you could borrow it off them. As a matter of fact, you can ask them to donate it to the school, which would be a really, really nice gesture. Okay, so we don't have any particular choice for plastic skulls. Spending $1,000 of a real skull is really a lot. They used to be $75 in the old days, but nevertheless. So you have the plastic skull available to you for now, as we review this information, and for when we do head and neck to review. Okay, it's your choice. I would suggest trying to find somebody who I could borrow it from. Okay, what we need to know for this section. Dr. Yuan has gone through an enormous amount of trouble. When you handed out the schedule, okay, that was handed out about 2 weeks ago, he has listed, I think, in 5.5 pages, all the structures you need to know. You need to know everything in here. What he's also added is the soft tissues which are associated with it, which is very, very helpful. Okay, so this is what you need to do, the 5.5 pages. Now, how do you do this? You have the handout from last Tuesday, something called the skull and something called the skull as a whole. You need to purchase a text, an atlas. The two that are recommended are Samson and McMinn, Color Atlas of Head and Neck. I personally prefer McMinn's, a Color Atlas of Head and Neck. Okay? Samson is good. It's black and white. The labels are frequently difficult to read. The numbers are difficult to read. It's not terribly clear. I prefer McMinn's Color Atlas of Human Anatomy. Again, if you can borrow it from a second-year person, that would be good, too. Okay? The Color Atlas of Head and Neck Anatomy will also serve you in good stead in the second when we go into January and February. So it'll be very useful there. Alrighty. Now, how do I go about... I'm sorry.
Can we
just in Russian. The Samson, I think, is actually out of print too. Okay, so if you want to use the Samson one, which is black and white, and only the skull, only, there's no soft tissue, you may need to borrow from the third year right now, right? Because last year, I think, it's out of print.
Thank you. Okay, I hadn't realized that. Okay, how do you study? How do you learn all this stuff? You have these two handouts, which I think are excellent. I didn't write them, okay, so I'm not being coy about this. The skull section, I would read it. It's written very tightly. It's very terse. I would read it, have the skull and the atlas, and follow exactly what it says. Everything I'm going to be saying today, and a lot more, is here. And the same is true in this region. So how I would study, I would need to know all the structures Dr. Yuan listed, 5.5 pages of it. And it listed in here, and it's a lot more in here. But I would use this as my key taking off. Okay? Now, again, you know we'll pick up the skulls. I'll try to end the lecture as early as possible. We'll get the skulls. Go up. There's two rooms where the changing medical students change, right across from Doreen's office. Dr. Singh will be giving out the skulls. Bernard Lamb, who's a third-year student, will be there to help with Dr. Singh. I'll be up on the 17th floor in room 201. So go in any direction. One skull per table and sort of hang around as a table.
Everyone, pick up a skull. Okay. Each group assign one representative to pick up a skull. And everyone go up to 17201. Right? So you know the room, right? The where you do the pathology. And it's much easier to study with the table. Much, much easier. And as a group, you can study better.
Thank you. Okay. A skull lecture, officially, starting now. The skull is the most complex portion of the human anatomy. In fact, probably of all vertebrate anatomy. A very basic question, which is going to sound very silly, you don't have to write this down, just listen, is why do we have a head? And it is a fortuitous event, a serendipitous event that we have a head. Not all forms of life have heads. Clams, grasses, all sorts, algae, coral, they do not have heads. The heads are characteristic of the vertebrata, which we are members of. And essentially what we have is the accumulation of various functional and operational areas of the body into one area. And it sort of just all fit in there in one way or another, which makes it very, very complicated. For example, this entire upper limb has one function: to put this hand where I can do something with. If I want to pick something up, I want to touch something, this entire upper limb does this, the shoulder, all of this. This region is filled with separate, discrete, non-related functions. My sense of smell is not related to my sense of vision. Vision is not related to hearing. Swallowing is not related to balance. These are all disparate elements that have come together. Okay? Now, you will get a fantastic lecture on Thursday from Dr. Moss Salentine on the organization of the head, and I don't want to go into that in any detail now. What I want to do is just define a few things and then tell you about Halloween. Okay, I'm going to draw a side view of a skull by doing it this way. That's pretty neat, right? It happens to be accurate. I can now do this. And divide the skull into the following components. A neurocranial portion. And a visceral or facial portion. The separation occurs in this green area. So we speak of a visceral cranium, which is the face, and a neurocranium, which houses and protects the brain. Then I have this green wedge. Okay? There, we find our organs of special sense. The organs of special sense, the skeletal elements of the organs of special sense, belong to both, this is important, both to the face and to the neurocranium. The portion that houses and protects the organs of special sense, their skeletal portion, the heart tissues, belong to both the face and the neurocranium. Closely related to this is the origins. And we have five separate origins of that skull. We have this piece, which is membranous bone. And that's the bony portion, not the brain. The green portion is chondrocranium, which means it has a cartilaginous precursor. And then we have the upper and lower jaws, which are part of the gill arches. And these are brachiomeric, upper and lower jaw. The base of the skull is somatic. Dr. April mentioned when he talked about the enumeration of cervical nerves that the cervical vertebra developmentally had formed the base of the skull, and that explains partially the 8 cervical nerves, 7 cervical vertebra. So that comes from the somatic portion of the body. So we have 4 so far. Membranous, cartilaginous, brachial arches, somatic, and teeth that come in separately. And the teeth are a separate element. Have you guys ever touched the shark? Right, it's rough. That is called chagrin. And you can dry the skin and use it as sandpaper. What that skin is, and indeed the portions, the shell portions, the, what is that thing on? Scales of fish are actually teeth, enamel organs of teeth. And there is our origin of that. So we have 5 separate origins, 3 separate developmental processes. Okay? Now, last week was Halloween. And I'm going to draw you a witch. Okay? And I'm going to start drawing just the skull portion. Here's the forehead. And then we can put in the nose. And then I could draw in the lower jaw. I could put in teeth. Okay? The skull portion, this should be a little bit bigger. Okay. Front part of a bony skull. A witch is an old woman. This curvature is characteristic of female skulls. We can, with a fair degree of accuracy, get a bony skull and maybe 80, 85% security if we knew what population it was from, say it's a female or a male. Okay? And this globular forehead is a typical female appearance. Okay? The other thing to appreciate is that cartilage grows continuously through life. And you'll find that if you look at me and other senior citizens, our noses are big and our ears are big. Of course, they keep growing. So here's this older lady, and she has a relatively large nose. Also, what occurs is that prior to dentistry, is that teeth were lost from the maxillary portion, upper jaw portion, and from the lower jaw portion. And what we find is the piece of bone, the bone that contains the roots of the teeth, the alveolar processes of the teeth. When the teeth are gone, this bone disappears. So if we lost the teeth in the maxilla and mandible, we'd have a repositioning of the mandible, which is going to be a lot smaller. Okay. That's the bottom of the mandible. And if I put the skin on, I would have, as, what is the Yellow Brick Road? What movie is that? Wizard of Oz. This is the Wicked Witch, and if I put a little mold, there's our Wicked Witch. So, what you're looking at is an elderly female. What we also are talking about, not only the sex differentiation, the forehead, but an aging phenomena. You can tell with a fair degree of accuracy, maybe 5 to 10 plus or minus 5 or 10 years, in the individuals that are over 25 or 30, how old the individual was at death. You can, with the eruption of teeth, tell the younger individual. Have you guys ever seen, like, what, these crime movies, cold case studies? They find the skull, and they're able to say, this is a 38-year-old female, or this is a 60-year-old male. It is possible to age an individual by their skull. It is also possible, with a less degree of certainty, to differentiate the population they are from. And you'll frequently find when they do reconstructions of the skeletal thing, I'm sure you've seen these on TV, that they know if it is a black person, a white person, an Asian person. That is a little not that settled, but you can differentiate various populations. And this is called forensic anthropology, amongst other things. So you can, from the bony skull, tell fair degree of accuracy the sex, the age, and the population from where it came. Okay, now what we're going to do is go into the lecture. Now, this is set up as almost a book. I'm going to be yapping about it. And it's a PDF file which you can download and read. And look at the pictures and read. Okay? I will try to point out the more salient features of this. Thank you, Michael.
The lecture has been posted in PDF files. So if you download right now, you can synchronize together. So.
Thanks, Frank. Okay. That's in the handout that you have as well. I've just listed it in this fashion as well. As I said, you should almost look at this as a text that is readable and it has tons of illustrations. The Frankfurt Plain. This will be applicable as well without the Yuan's lectures, knowing the fact that we orient the skull at the Frankfurt Plain, and these are the landmarks. So all these skulls have a constant orientation for comparative purposes. Now, again, just terminology. Based on the Frankfurt Plain, which is a plane which utilizes the inferior margin of the bony orbits and the superior margin of the external auditory meatus, and that's parallel, and everything else goes in. And now we can look at the skull from the side, from the front, from the top, from the bottom, and where else? We have five directions. It said bottom, no?
Lateral.
All right. Well, let's sit here. Frontalis, occipitalis, vertical, basalis, and lateralis. Okay. So I will be showing you illustrations of all of these. They're all in the textbooks. Okay? Now, Dr. Morse, who was a thesis sponsor of mine and many, many years ago, was really a fantastic. You have missed him. He is, unfortunately, deceased last year, but he is great. He claims that the German helmets from the Second World War were organized so they would look good on the Frankfurt Plain. I don't know if that's true, but it's a good story. Okay, what you need to know is All the bones. All the bones of the bony skull. The 22 bones, we didn't include the three ear ossicles, and we'll go through these, going through the number, etc. Dr. April has it nicely arranged in paired bones and unpaired bones. Whatever works for you goes out. So we'll be going and talking about all these bones. Now, what we need to do as well, and this is in the handout that you have, is correlate the surface features with the bony features. And we have some additional features, also skeletal elements, cartilaginous, in the thyroid cartilage and the hyoid bone. I haven't included the hyoid bone, but it's in there as well. And I would read this. I can sit here or stand here and read these. Number one is two, number two is this, number three is that, etc. Okay? This is not that complex. And we need to know all of this. Okay? It is not that much. Most of the stuff you know already. We're going to look at the articulated skull, putting all the bones together, but before we do that, we're going to tear it apart. And this is a fairly good illustration. I have another one, same one, later on. So we have separated the neurocranium from the spinal cranium, and the spot in between, the yellowish portion, which is the sphenoid bone, is essentially where we would have the primitive chondrocranium, the organs of special sense. The face, the malar bone, temporal bone, frontal bone, parietal, occipital, etc. This is an exploded skull. This is known as a Buchene preparation. Numerous years ago, we had here, not you and I were discussing this, we don't know where it is at the moment, they would quote-unquote explode a skull. They would take a relatively young skull, whose sutures were not fused. The sutures are where the two bones abut to each other. The growing skull, these bones are separate to allow the expansion. A way of telling the age of a individual is how the pattern of fusion of these sutures. So once you had a skull with the sutures not closed, it was possible, there were numerous ways of doing this, to fill up the cranial cavity with dried beans, put water in it, and let it expand, and everything would come apart. But anyway, and this would be put on a stand with all the bones in their proper orientation. And this is a view of that, basically. We should be able, at least visually, in our own minds, put them all together. Here is the skull from the front view. Nicely color-coded. And we're looking at the skull in the Frankfurt orientation. And we're looking at this region here, for example. This is where we have the external representation of where we have the organs of special sense. The bony orbits, smell, and back on the side, which I'll show you in a moment, is where the middle and inner ear is, where we have hearing, static, and dynamic balance. The upper jaw, the lower jaw, and the various elements. The skull is a fascinating area of study. You notice this little notch here, this notch here, and this notch here. Those are the surface, the foramina through which branches of the fifth cranial nerve come out. Afferent branches. And those names are not that complicated. We have a foramina or notch, in this case it's a foramina, which is called the supraorbital. We have a foramina which is beneath the orbit, which is the infraorbital. And we have which comes out here in the mandible. This is called the mental foramen. The chin is called the mentum. So it is a mental foramen. You'll note that these three foramina open up in a straight line. And we have the landmark, which I'll discuss next week, to the region of the head is the branches of the fifth cranial nerve. The fifth cranial nerve is your meal ticket, essentially. You need to know the fifth cranial nerve. And here are the terminal branches, the afferent branches of the fifth cranial nerve coming onto the surface of the face. All this that you see here, okay, is innervated afferently by the fifth cranial nerve. First division of 5, second division of 5, third division of 5. And we see the foramina through which they come. Okay, and again, all these little things you could read yourselves. Side view. Norma lateralis. That green line is the Frankfurt plane. Inferior margin of the bony orbit, superior margin of the external auditory meatus and the bones. Again, color-coded. This is all spelled out quite nicely on that handout called the skull. It's tightly written. You can't, like, skip a word. It's not a novel, so you can't read it as a novel. And we have all these elements going through here. Beautiful. I think the skull is fantastic. If we remove the zygomatic arch, which is this region right here, we find a fossa, infratemporal fossa, which is chock full of things. It is like a ham sandwich. The two muscles, which are the bread, and the neurovascular structures are the ham, or is the ham, okay? And this is like really critical to your guy, to you guys, involved in chewing, swallowing, opening and closing the mouth, etc., the pterygoid muscles. It's an area that you'll be dissecting out next year. And again, the green line is the Frankfurt plane. Norma occipitalis, posterior view. We saw some of this last week when we dissected out the suboccipital triangle. But here we have a lot more. We have the palate, hard palate, the teeth, and the inside curvature of the mandible. The mastoid processes and the attachments. The foramina. And here we're looking at sutures. Sutures are where the bones abut. Sutures is where growth occurs. Sutures allow the child to pass through the birth canal. Has anybody seen or experienced the birth? And if they need forceps, they put this huge stuff like big, I guess they look like, huge forceps. They put it on the child's head, and you hear crack, crack, crack. And that's the bones overlapping. If you ever seen a child that's newly born, it has a oddly shaped head, which has been molded by its passage through the birth canal, going through there. And that is allowed, and I'll show you a picture of that a little bit later, by the sutures. And these will eventually close as the individual gets old. Now, sort of as a little aside, I know you guys are not going to be thrilled to hear this. Imagine me. You're only built to last 25 years. Okay? After 25, it's downhill. A little slower in some, a little faster in others. There's a whole series of things that show this. One of the elements is the closure of the sutures. What sutures do is help absorb energy. I don't know if you've had little children and they fall like on a bathroom tiles with their heads. If it were you or I, or specifically me, that would be a total disaster. And the reason a child can take that fall is that the bones at the sutures are open, so the bones will move and absorb the energy. When these sutures close, a similar blow will cause the fracture of the bones. And not a good thing to occur. So the closure, which we use as an aging phenomenon as well as eruption of teeth, is associated as these close off. A really old individual, with the exception of some, perhaps the squamosal suture, is completely closed. And it just becomes a hard shell, which is easy to fracture. But anyway, we're looking at this, and you'll notice a series of ridges and marks. These are the mastoid processes. I'm going to go back to one here. Let me go back to another one. Mastoid process. It doesn't really develop until just about puberty. In infants, there isn't very much there. It develops because of the development of the sternocleidomastoid muscle, which attaches there. It is filled with air cells. Again, just a slight little anecdote. If you see individuals of my age, frequently they'll have a depression behind the ear. I could feel right here my mastoid process. Okay? Now, prior to the advent of penicillin, an infection of these air sinuses would continuously infect the individual. You couldn't give enough penicillin. It wasn't there. So what you needed to do is go in and fracture this bone and drain it. The sternocleidomastoid muscle attaches on the other side. So these individuals would have a depression here. Okay? Now, with the advent of penicillin, you still have to give massive doses. Of some interest, that's part of the temple bone. The temple bone is one of these bones which has all sorts of things. It has the middle ear, has the inner ear, and has the facial canal. Has all sorts of interesting structures. It is a difficult area to do surgery on. Sort of, again, as another little anecdote, there used to be surgeons who would do mastectomies. Not the breast, this mastoid is breast-like, and dissect it out. With the advent of penicillin and its derivatives, they were out of luck. So they had to go back and take different residencies. They became ear, nose, and throat specialists, etc. So be conscious of that. It may happen to you. But anyway, nowadays, if any surgeon needs to do a mastectomy on the skull for a carcinoma or something, they actually send out invitations to maxillofacial surgeons. The base of the skull is a real difficult area to dissect. I'm going to do a mastectomy. Come and see how it works. It is rare for this to occur nowadays. It occurs, but not as usual. Okay, so we're looking at the mastoid process, which is also an age-related element. And here we're looking at the infratemporal fossa and this element here. The norma verticalis, the sutures. You know what Sagittarius is? You know, in the good old days, when I was growing up, it used to be, what's your sign? You know, at bars. Not that I ever went to those things, but anyway. And it's like, you guys don't do this anymore. And there's one of the signs that's called Sagittarius, which is the archer. Okay? I preferred, you know, when somebody would say slippery when wet or something like that, but they would generally say stop sign. That's a terrible... Okay. In a child, this looks like... I used to be young once, actually. Okay. This looks somewhat like an arrow. And the archer Sagittarius, and that suture is called the sagittal suture. And there's where we get the sagittal plane. It's coming, if we went down the center, we would have straight down the body, we would divide it into two mirror images, the sagittal plane and then the parasagittal plane. This looks like a corona, a crown, and it's called the coronal plane. And we also have the term the coronal suture. And if I went back, this looks like the Greek letter lambda, lambdoidal suture. Frequently, there's another suture in here. And this is called the Inca bone, because the frequency is really quite extensive in the Inca population. And not infrequently, you'll see some of the skulls we have, they're little bones, intrasutural bones, which are called Wormian bones from the anatomist, Dr. Worm. Okay? So we have sutures, and again, they're not that difficult to remember. There's some sort of logic associated with their aspect of it. Okay, sutures. We're looking at the coronal suture, sagittal suture, lambdoidal suture, noma verticalis, and here we have an infant. An occipital bone, two parietal bones, and a frontal bone. Notice that there are two frontal bones. This, on occasion, does not fuse, and it's called a metopic suture. Metopic suture. And when you do x-rays, if you see a line there, it could be a fracture or it could be a metopic suture. Well, again, anecdotes. I'm just filled with anecdotes. All right. For some obscure reason, I have a hobby. That means I don't have a life. I collect skulls. Not real skulls, but plastic skulls. You'd be amazed. Things like, you know, they have rings with skulls, and everybody has bandanas with skulls and all sorts of stuff. And when I have enough money, I buy Detsky, these little ivory Japanese skulls. Actually, I only got one. And the one I have has a metopic suture. Okay, it was. Well, I mean, it's expensive. But anyway, the one I have, the little Netsuki, the little Japanese ivory little things, has a metopic suture, which I thought was of some great interest. Okay, we're looking at the fetal skull, and these are the fontanelles, the little fountains, because as the heart beats, you can actually see the beating through this membranous portion. And notice how loose these are, and this allows the molding of the skull for childbirth. Now, the inside of the noma verticalis, the inside of this top portion. One thing should strike you, looking at this and this, is how different they are. Notice how smooth the outer surface is. There's some markings here for the attachment of the temporalis muscles. There's some emissary foramina, parietal foramina, but everything is essentially smooth. Unless it was a gorilla, and it would have a ridge. Well, looking in the inside, it looks very different. You notice between the outer table of bone and the inner table of bone, we have these little holes. This is called the diploe. And basically, this functions as a series of struts, like I-beams, okay, that we have in construction. There's blood fluid running in here, and this is the inner table, and that's the outer table. Of some great interest is that the inner table shows structures that are related to it. For example, the internal carotid artery has this branching aspects, which you can't see on the outside. The granular fovea, or granular arachnoid granulations, where the cerebral spinal fluid goes back in. Here is the location of the superior sagittal sinus. You can see some of the sagittal suture, but you'll notice that the inner table of bone does not respond to external stimulus and vice versa. The external portion of the skull cap does not respond to what goes on inside. So we have two functional units. And this will be a little more complex as we go to the base, the internal base of the skull. There is like tons and tons of good stuff associated with the skulls. Okay. Noma basalis. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. If you compare that to this. Okay. You can understand. Wow, wow, wow. Okay. This is the skull base. Maxillofacial surgeons, neural surgeons, the approach to the brain frequently is via the base of the skull. Very complicated, and you got to be damn good to go through here. And I'm sure you guys will be doing some of this stuff as well. All right, we're looking at the whole region. Now, these are in different planes. This part, the heart palate, is closer to you. This is somewhat further away. This is the foramen magnum, which means the large hole. This is a ridge where the ligamentum nuchae attaches. These are the articular facets to the first cervical vertebra. This is where the temporomandibular joint is located, and we see a lot of foramina, the mastoid process. Palate. Beneath here, we have the nasal cavity. Here's the arch, the buttressing formed by the zygomatic arch. Obviously, the teeth, all sorts of... Again, we can go through... We will know all these foramina and what goes through them. Okay? It's in that skull thing, and we will have wires that you can actually go through, and you can also buy pipe cleaners and put them through there. And we will know all of this. Why? Because that's the profession you have chosen. All right? You'll associate this with the 12 cranial nerves as well. Okay. Again, this has become like knowing your own telephone number or your own address. Okay. Synovial joints. Aha. We had the skull. Let me go back a couple. Okay. A whole skull. The sutures move, etc., very slightly. They absorb energy. But the only thing basically moving here is the mandible at the temporomandibular joint. And the skull relative to the cervical spine. So we have, wrong direction. Okay, excellent. We have the temporomandibular joint, and I'll be lecturing on this, and I think somebody else will be lecturing it as well. This is the articulation of the temporomandibular joint. And I think I mentioned here that you have sometimes two convex surfaces articulating, as we did in the atlanto-occipital joints. And here we have the temporomandibular joint. And here's the articulation, here's the occipital portion, atlanto-occipital joint with C1 would fit right in here. So the only movement basically we have is between the skull as a whole and the cervical spine. And the cervical spine does move, that's what we lectured on last week, and then the movement of the mandible relative to the rest of the skull, which is, again, a very significant element. The base of the skull and the attachments. We saw some of the semispinalis capitis, rectus capitis, posterior, minor, etc. You know some of this, but we'll be going around in here. This, by and large, will be covered to an extremely extensive extent in January as we go through here. The foramen magnum and all these muscles. It is a complicated region. Why? Because we have numerous functions. Operations all pushed together in a serendipitous fashion. Okay? It's not the hand. There's a textbook by Legros Clark, Principles of Anatomy as Seen in the Hand. Okay? With the exception of the parasympathetic system, everything in here is a principle of anatomy. Heck, there's more anatomy in one little piece here than in my entire body. That's how complex this whole thing. This is relatively simple and straightforward. Okay, another view of that, associated soft tissues. We have removed half of the mandible. And again, a lot of this is from various textbooks, and I think you should look at this more or less as a textbook. This is from Pernkoff. McMinn has very similar pictures. And again, as you go through it, read the handout that you have and try to figure out everything else that's going on with this PDF file and with the handout that Dr. Ewan has given. Here is a schematic representation. I need to go into a small little tangent. what is going to be available to you, it's on the courseworks, is a series of illustrations which I took from Grant's Method of Anatomy and a few other textbooks. And these are schematic illustrations. They're simplified illustrations. Give you a lot more information in a schema. And this is the features of the base of the skull. As you go through here, you notice this is somewhat easier, somewhat clearer than maybe this one. Okay? So we have, that is complicated, and if we would go back here, the labeling is clearer, the foramina clearer, and we have some more of that. This is also in that handout that you'll get tons of illustrations, and this will help you a lot, the relationships.
This handout will be given to you on Thursday, okay? Today, the print shop, they closed, so we are only one here studying, so the rest are resting.
Okay, very similar aspect of it. Again, I could read this to you, but I don't know what that's going to do. Oops, sorry. Internal view of the skull. We had the basor, dorma basalis. Here is the internal portion of it. And, again, color-coded nicely. This is the anterior cerebral fossa, the middle cerebral fossa, the posterior cerebral fossa. We will be cutting off the calvaria in January and looking at all these structures. Now, fortunately, we have a skull. It is possible to put a wire through any of these foramina and see it come out on the other side. You're not going to be able to do that on a cadaver. We'll be able to find things back and forth. But the advantage of this is we can go put things through and find it on the other side. We have a fossa where the frontal lobes are located, the middle cranial fossa where the temporal lobes are located, and here is where the cerebellum is located. And that's going to be fascinating when you dissect the anatomy of this region, when we remove the brain and see all this good stuff. All right, comparison of the internal and external regions. Now, we have all the foramina, and you go back and forth. I have a little schematic of this in a little while. And you can see the foramina coming through, the foramen ovale, the oval foramen, etc. Any attachment of the various muscles, and no attachments here of the muscles. Ain't none in the internal portion. Preview, things that we will be doing when we get to the cadaver, actually. And again, here is some of the schema, exit sites of the intracranial. Now, you need to be aware of the fact that the lining of the cranial cavity, as well as the lining of the vertebral canal, is by dura. And then we have the arachnoid, and then we have the pia. The same structures you saw when we did the laminectomy. The dura and the bone do not correspond. They apparently have evolved at different rates. So when we remove the brain, and I don't have a picture of this, the dura will show you the various structures going through. And they may go underneath the dura for a little while before they exit some other place. Okay? So these are the structures after the dura has been peeled back. If we had the dura, we'd have a slightly different configuration. Not markedly different, slightly different. And we would see all these structures. And you will be able, when we take out the brain, which is very a fun thing to do, is as it comes out, we could see all the 12 cranial nerves and the blood vessels, everything that it says in the textbook. Okay, so it should be fun. It is a lot more fun if you know what you studied this before. It ain't going to be fun if you just go, I pull the brain out. Okay, you need to be totally well prepared for this. Okay. Some of the schematic aspects of it. We have the dura being innervated by afferent fibers, and here's some of the dura, and these relationship. This will make a lot more sense after you start looking at the internal aspect of the skull. Here is a highly schematic region, which is sort of key. Now, Acela, there's a spot where looks like a Turkish saddle. And it also could look like a four-poster bed, or it could be a twisted chair. And it is the hypophyseal fossa, or the cella tertia, the Turkish saddle. This is the posterior aspect of it. And then we have foramina that we really need to know. Spinosum, that's called, because it's by the sphenoid spine, we have the foramen ovale, the foramen rotundum, and superior orbital fissure. The three branches of the trigeminal nerve, which is the fifth cranial nerve, first division, second division, third division. And it's here, you want to see the fifth cranial nerve? It's right here. Ophthalmic, maxillary, mandibular. Notice how it covers my entire face. It supplies the muscles of mastication and sensory to the face. Landmark to the entire face. This doesn't make sense to you now, but remember sympathetic chain? Remember the ganglia? We didn't talk about parasympathetic ganglia. In the region of the head, we have four parasympathetic ganglia. All four parasympathetic ganglia are associated with branches of the fifth cranial nerve. That's why it's essential to know the fifth cranial nerve. The four ganglia, parasympathetic ganglia, all associated with the branches of the fifth cranial nerve. That is key and really important to understand. I don't have it here now, but do that. Okay, here's just enlargements of the same area. Foramen ovale, spinosum, where the internal carotid artery comes out. I'm sorry, middle meningeal artery comes out. And here's where the carotid artery lies, the foramen lacerum, the lacerated foramen. And here is a view of the inner ear. And notice the eighth cranial nerve, internal auditory meatus. And again, this is enlarged and focused. Again, one of these, you're going to get this as well, a schematic of this, which I think is a lot easier than those illustrations. And it's from Grant's Method of Anatomy. We're going to learn about the greater petrosal nerve and stuff like that. Mid-sagittal section of the cranium. Okay. The nasal septum. The inner portion. And you can see the inner surface, the branching of the middle meningeal artery looping around. And it forms depressions into the inner table of bone. A fetal skull. Notice a very small face, a very, very big neurocranium, and the features. Notice there is no mastoid process. Notice that we have the fontanelles. Notice how all this is put together. Growth of the skull. This is related to our growth. The brain essentially stopped growing at 6 years of age. There's a slight amount of growth after that. The brain grows very rapidly in the first 2 years. It slows down to about six, and there's a slight increase after that. Okay? Since the brain forces the cranial bones apart, the size of the neurocranium is dependent on the size of the brain. And you can have things like a microcephalic, which can be due for a lot of reasons, or you can have a hydrocephalic, where there's a blockage of the cerebral spinal fluid, and there's an accumulation of fluid inside the brain, and you have these real huge, huge heads. Because as the brain keeps expanding, the bones keep growing towards each other and never reach each other. So you would have that. So here we could see essentially a newborn, very flat mandible. The neurocranium is not that much smaller than an adult. It's smaller, but not really that much. But look at the size of the face. And here is, if we superimposed all of it, that the brain keeps growing and the face grows a lot more. You've had this experience, I'm sure, that you have a favorite niece or nephew or cousin or something like that, that you see as a child. There's a cute as a button child, right? 4, 5, 6 years old, cute. Then you don't see them for several years. And you see them when they're 13, 14, or 15. You say, oh, my God, who hit them with an ugly stick? Because what you see is a cute little face like that. Cute little big eyes, small little face. And then he grows up and he or she has a face. Look at that. If you visualize this and you remember the child as this, and then he grows up to an adult. And he has an adult's face. 14, 15, 16, 17 year old. Oh my God, what happened? And again, you could see the size. It's here, basically, going through. Maybe I should have said an ugly stick, but anyway. You know, there's always a shock when that occurs. Okay. Child and adult ratios. Again, the changes that occur. I'm rushing because I want to give you guys a small break. Okay, skull shapes. Dr. Ewan will be talking about different groups of people have different skull shapes, and there's a whole thing about more or less, I'm not sure, but basically it's related to genetics, I think. Okay, now, Darcy Thompson wrote a book on growth and form about 1917, and he has an interesting thing, is that if you put, for example, a human skull, a young human skull, on a rubber sheet, basically, and these are Cartesian coordinates, and then you modify them, and you can wind up with various forms. Like, here's a baboon, and this is a chimp. And you can do the same thing in various forms of scapulae. So if this is a genetic thing in terms of the growth, and here we have, again, just this and the chimp, and here is a human skull, and here is a female gorilla skull. And you see the difference in the size of the splenocranium. And that could be the result of the increase in this lower portion, the growth occurring in that lower portion. Very fascinating study. He's done this with crabs. He's done these with flowers, with dinosaurs, all sorts of animals, and an interesting aspects of it. Okay, skull architecture. I'm not going to spend time on that at all. And here. Okay, why don't we take a real short break, and we can pick up...